That was an example. We're all familiar with the Muppets, but that was taken straight from a DVD, which used audio coding for the sound and video coding for the video. And in fact, if you think about it, almost 90%+, well, probably even higher than that, of what people listen to is coded audio material. They listen on their walk, whatever it is, their iPods, walk thingies, on the digital radio, DVD. If they go to the theater, they're hearing digital sound, but all of them are coded formats. And it does seem to me that a primary technology for audio delivery in the 21st century is coded audio, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing. So what I want to do is to spend about an hour, talking about audio coding. Okay, what aspects of an audio signal actually let us compress it? Lossy audio coders are often described from the first point of view by reference to their psychoacoustic properties, but that's not the only properties they have. So I thought we'd just come at it from a slightly different angle, and we'd come at it from the angle of information theory. So what I'm going to go through this talk is consider audio coding from the point of view of the information and information coding. And hopefully by the end of this, you'll actually find that if we take this viewpoint, we can actually look at an audio codec and, in fact, a video codec, basically from the same point of view, with three basic blocks of stuff going on in there. Okay, see if I can get this to work. Right, so what is information? What is it about an audio signal that makes it interesting? What makes you want to listen to an audio signal? Tell me, and if it's panto, we can go, oh no, it isn't, oh yes, it is, okay. All right, so I want a proper response. So is a sine wave musically interesting? Come on, no. Oh no, it isn't. All right, is silence interesting? Sometimes, cage, yes. Depends on the silence, doesn't it? Some silence is actually quite interesting, usually because it's not silent. All right, is white noise interesting? Pink noise? The noise of a running brook, which is sort of pinkish. So it's interesting. Right, I think everybody was pretty firm on the idea listening to a sine wave is sort of torture. Silence can be interesting. Noise is interesting. Why? What aspects of silence make it interesting? What precedes it? Okay, that's interesting. So it's like a... Also, I think if you do listen to one of John Cage's performances, what actually happens in the silence when you find that silence actually isn't very silent? Okay. I don't know what the new single to compete with the X Factor's putative hit. I believe lots of stars have recorded John Cage's 4 minutes, 33 seconds. So at least the performance fees should have been cheap. But I'd like to put to you that it's the change. It's actually change and surprise that makes audio interesting. Somebody over there said silence after a noise. Sometimes going into silence after it's being really loud is interesting because it's a change. And that's actually much more interesting. So audio information is about change. And what makes something surprising? It's unexpected, and you can show that surprise is sort of inversely proportional to the probability. The more unlikely something is, the more surprising it is. And it's independent of what's happened before. As a classic example, if the Prime Minister says, when one of his ministers has been caught doing something slightly dodgy, X has my full support... What's the headlines the next day or the day after? Fired. Such and such is fired. All right, so that's not very interesting. That's not information because it's predictable. Okay, so previous information is actually redundant, and in fact the video people are really lucky because most video is deadly boring when you look at it from frame to frame because each frame is pretty much the same. The one I always like to say is if we did it on security videos, we'd really get huge compression rates because essentially it would all cancel out except for the occasional rodent that walks across the screen. So basically, to make something surprising, to have lots of information, you want it to be low probability and to be independent. Right. That brings us to, if you like, my model of an archetypal audio coder, could be a video coder as well. And that is that we have something that has three basic stages in it. We have, see if my anxiety amplifier works, a stage that removes redundancy, that removes the predictability from the signal. A stage which does something rather clever, but tries to maximize the bits used, if you like, the power of the bits used to code the signal, posh name entropy coder. Those two things together actually make a lossless coder. And in the middle is our psychoacoustic model, or our visual acoustic model, and extra quantization that, if you like, reduces the bit rate further. You can get about 2-to-1 just with the signal redundancy stage and the entropy coding stage. If you look at something like FLAC or Monkey Audio, it's typically giving you 2-to-1. To get the 11-to-1 you need for sort of 128 kilobits MPEG, then you'll have to have some lossy quantization. Right, so we can think of an archetypal audio coder having these three stages: entropy coder, signal redundancy movement, and then the psychoacoustic model. And I'm, in the popular way of all academics, going to start arse about face and start with the back and look at information and entropy coding, because it links in with the other stuff. Right, so in order to actually start thinking about what we're doing with entropy coding, we have to think about, how do we measure information? We actually need to know the and be able to measure the information content of a real signal to know how surprising it is, all right? So that means we've got to gather some statistics about what's the chances of things happening. We also, very importantly, need to be able to link or convert that measure into something that means something for our real-world hardware. We live in a binary environment. So something that's useful for us to actually convert it to is the number of bits necessary to transmit that information. So how can we measure the information source in a way that relates to the bits needed to transmit it? Okay, a couple of jargon terms. Okay, a source consists of a set of symbols, which we call an alphabet, and the symbols are going to be transmitted using binary codes because we live in a binary environment. And at great public expense, I've brought a few information sources along with me. So here's my first information source. All right, this is a D20 die, inflatable D20 die. Right, 20 faces, nice Pythagorean solid. If I roll it, then we'll get a number. What's the number there? 9, okay? And I think you can, I'm not sure this would be true. I think if we did the statistics on this, we'd find it wasn't quite unbiased. But in principle, if it was a good die, then we would have a source which would give us 20, this source has 20 symbols. And each symbol has an equal probability of occurring of 1 in 20. I went further than that. That's my biggest information source, by the way. I brought a few other ones. Unfortunately, I can't juggle, otherwise that would have been quite fun. I bought a smaller version of my 20 unit information source, but this is an interesting one, this yellow one. This is an 8 symbol information source. An 8 symbol information source we could express with a 3-bit binary word. In fact, I've got an 8 symbol information source sitting up there. It has 8 possible symbols, 0 to 7, and we can represent it with a 3-bit binary code. That's an example of an alphabet of 8 symbols. Okay. A CD, on the other hand, has 16-bit samples, 65,536 possibilities. It's got that many symbols. So the alphabet in a CD is 65536 symbols. But interesting question, right? We already know, all right, this information source is really rather interesting because it's uniform. The chances of any particular side coming up, whether it's 6 or that wasn't supposed to happen. Two, or any other such number, is equiprobable. A CD, we already know pretty much intuitively that stuff around zero is much more likely to happen than stuff around plus or minus 32,000. Okay? So how do we get that into bits of information? What does the actual information of a source represent? Okay? So come up with a concept, first concept, which is called self-information, which is the number of bits the probability of a symbol occurring actually represents. Okay? If we have a b-bit word, we have 2 to the 8 possibilities. A 3-bit word, we've got 8 possibilities, and they've got equal probability if it's this type of source of 2 to the minus b. We're interested in relating probabilities to bits, so if we take the log to the base 2 of its 1 over its probability, its surprise value, we'll get a number that represents the number of bits of surprise this object has. Now, this object is a little bit dull because it's got only 8 possibilities. It's got 3 bits of information. Okay, what happens if we have sources that have uneven possibilities for the symbols? I've got a few examples here. Some are, right? The one I really like is the single symbol, right? This is the texter that's fallen asleep at the keyboard, okay? And their nose has hit the letter K, and you're getting K, 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 K all the time. So the symbol K has a probability of 1, and everything else has a probability of 0. Well, if we work out log to the base 2 of the minus log to the base 2 of that, we'll find that probability of 1 log to the base 2 of 1 is 0. It's got 0 bits of self-information. One where nothing happens has actually got more self-information. It's got infinite amount of self-information according to our equation, but of course it's never transmitted. So the point is moot as to whether it's useful or not. Possibly a bit more interesting is the situation where you have one symbol that's highly unlikely. Here's where you have one that's 0.01, and to compensate, all the other symbols are slightly more likely, and we find that the self-information for that one, which is 1 in 100, is 6 and a bit bits, 6.4 bits. But the actual information of all the other symbols has gone down because they now become more likely, and they're only worth 2.83 bits of information. So they're worth less than 3 bits, and one symbol's actually worth more than 3 bits in terms of the information carried. And then just to get to a much more realistic example, I just don't think this thing's got the power. A 5-level audio quantizer, which is the sort of thing you might find in an MPEG codec. Zero is highly probable at 60%. It's actually only worth 0.74 bits of information. And levels plus and minus 1 worth 2.74 bits. Levels plus and minus 2, because they're so unlikely, are actually worth more than 3 bits. They're worth 4.32 bits. So, interesting, but not the complete story. Clearly, we need to actually do some way of collating all these bits of self-information together to work out the average bits per symbol over the whole alphabet. And we do that by multiplying each of the symbols, the self-information of each of those symbols, by the probability of them actually happening. So again, if we look at the uniform probability source, each symbol has a self-information of 3 bits. It's actually going to happen 1/8 of the time. We add it all up together, we find the average number of bits per symbol is 3, which is kind of comforting because we're using a 3-bit word to encode it. The jargon term for this is entropy. It's got nothing to do with thermodynamic entropy. What happened is the people that actually developed these theorems in the 30s at Bell Labs looked at this equation and said, ooh, it's like the entropy equation. Why don't we call it entropy? That's the only reason it's called entropy. It doesn't really have any hard link with entropy. If we look at the one symbol equal to having a surprise value of 100 and the other symbols being slightly lower, we find that the average bits per symbol for that source is actually slightly less than 3 bits. And if we look at the entropy, average bits per symbol for our audio quantizer, we actually find that the entropy for that, the average bits per symbol, is incredibly much lower. Although we're using 3 bits, have to use 3 bits to encode it, if we use a fixed word length, it's actually only worth about 1.7 bits per symbol on average information. Okay, so a couple of interesting things come out of this. One is, very importantly, that the uniform source, my little D8 dice, is the best information source we can have. This is wonderful. This is a perfect information source. Not very useful, but it's a perfect information source because it actually has the maximum number of bits per symbol. Anything that's uneven actually has less than the equivalent symbols of a uniform source. Sometimes a lot less. So, big million-dollar question. We know our audio signal spends lots more time near zero than it does at the peaks. What's the entropy of an audio signal? I'll stop it there. It's 4 minutes, 46 seconds long. A great computational cost, actually not that much computational cost these days. I actually did the PDF for this song. It contains, just in case anybody interested, contains 25,225,200 samples. Okay? I'm pushing both tracks together in total. That's actually 2^24.59, about 2^24.6 samples. Okay? Right. Looking at this probability, it's really very interesting. For a start, zero, I keep hitting the wrong button on this thing, zero. Okay, it just doesn't... Ah, I see. It's a classic battery problem. It's flash-in-the-pan stuff. Okay, it turns out zero is so... It's actually got 0.02%. It's 0.19-something percent probability. So zero is the most likely level to ever happen. Okay? And immediately after zero, it all drops down to sort of less than 1 in 1,000. You're sort of 1 in 5,000 or thereabouts. And then, this is a logarithmic y-axis. You can see there's a sort of linear decrease as we go up in level. And things get rapidly less and less likely as we go up in level. And when we get to about plus and minus 1,500, because I've folded over the plus and minuses here, we find that that bottom 0.0004 is where we're counting one sample per bin over 25 million plus odd samples. Okay, so there's an exponential drop in probability for higher signal levels. And if you look at any audio signal level or speech signal, you'll find very similar curves. Very interesting. The actual probability density actually goes off exponentially with signal value. It's quite interesting to change the left-hand side, the y-axis of the graph. This is the exact same graph, but now it's plotted with self-information. I've kept the signs negative just to make the scale work and come the same shape round. But we see that the zero is only worth about 5 bits worth of information. Nearer up to zero, we've got about 11 bits worth of information. And thereafter, it gets progressively more and more surprising until at the limit of my statistical count, and these are very noisy estimates, I've got about 24.6 bits of information. Now remember, the number of samples I looked at was 2^24.6. Okay, so this is in a sense an artifact of my statistics. If I could have looked at a longer signal, but it would have to be a lot longer, then I could have pulled that graph a bit further down. Okay, and it turns out the entropy, The average bits per symbol, if I do the calculation, comes out to about 11.61 bits. Okay, so our CD, although we're using 16 bits to encode it, on average, each sample is only worth 11 odd bits, 11 and a bit bits. So, you know, if we'd known about this when we developed the CD standard, we could have actually boosted the size of it by about a third or thereabouts, or used a smaller disk, or something like that. So, somewhat less than 16 bits. Okay, that's quite interesting. So, first stage in our archetypal audio coder maximizes information content via redundancy removal and entropy coding. What do I mean by that? Entropy coding. Clearly, coding real signals with fixed binary words is actually inefficient because real signals don't have equal probability. Real signals have more surprising bits and less surprising bits. So what we really need to do is use a variable length words whose length is similar to the signal self-information. You know, if we could match the bit length of the word we encoded them into its self-information, if we knew it, then we'd probably be doing something approaching a good job. Of course, the interesting question is, how on earth can we do this? Well, one method, which is used in MPEG, is Huffman coding. I wish I had students like him. Invented by David Huffman as a PhD student in response to a homework problem set by Fano. Okay, a kind of high-tension sort of class there. So let's just have a look at Huffman encoding of a five-level audio signal, okay? Because it's quite interesting. And this is actually a case of where Huffman, who I guess was probably in his mid-20s at this point, actually outdid Fano, because Fano and Shannon had a coding theory for optimal coding, and his did better. But theirs went top-down, his went bottom-up. But let's have a look at what he's doing. So Huffman coding, very simple idea, and I'm sure this is definitely a shower inspiration type thing. I'm sure he didn't think that, you know, it just must have come to him doing something like that. Right, the first thing you do is you sort the symbols into a list ordered according to their probability, right? And remember, low probability symbols imply high self-information. So you sort them into descending probabilities, and you start at the bottom of the list. And you combine the two lowest probabilities and generate a binary symbol bit to select between them. So here we are, we've got our symbol 2 and minus 2, both at probabilities of 5%. And we say, okay, we're going to allocate a bit to select between those two possibilities. That total data stream now has a composite probability of 10%, right? So we compare. Take the next step, which is we compare the next two lowest probabilities, the 10% and the 15% associated with minus 1, and we do the same thing again. We say, let's combine the two lowest probabilities and, again, allocate another bit to select between those two, right? So, but we still got to leave something left over to do selections, right? In my fairly contrived example, it naturally progresses up. If you had a uniform source of equal probabilities, what you'd actually find is you then select some other bits to combine together and not link up the tree quite in the same way. So it can get a bit complicated, but for typical audio signals, this is the sort of behavior you see, right? And basically repeat. Combine the two lowest probabilities. Now, this is quite interesting because you'll notice the two lowest probabilities, one had a probability total of 25%. The next symbol up had 15%, which is lower, but both pairs to get the pair together were still the two lowest probabilities, so we didn't have to do anything different. Again, generate an extra bit to select between them and continue until you've run out of symbols to do that to. And you end up with this code, which you can see we've got 4 bits for the lowest probability symbols, 3 bits for the next one up, 2 bits for the next one up, and 1 bit for the most probable symbol. And providing the receive end knows the maximum length of the word, you don't need to tell the other end where one word starts and the other one stops, because all words either start with a zero, or after you've had four bits worth, you've got to start a new word. Okay, so as long as the receive end knows that you can't have a symbol longer than four bits, you don't have to put any commas in. You don't have to put in any additional bits in to say where one symbol starts and one symbol stops. And the jargon term for that is a comma-free variable length entropy code, because you don't have to put any commas in. Okay, quite simple. In fact, really remarkably simple to do. Can actually be performed in order log to the base 2 times the number of symbol times. And if you're really clever, you can get that down to linear time. So computationally these days, not outrageously expensive. So how well does it do? Right, here's our symbols. That would be the fixed length binary code on the left. Our symbols and their probabilities. Self-information, 4 bits for the least probable, 2.74 for the next least probable, and 0.74 for the zero. Actual bits used, 1 bit, 2 bit, 3 bits, 4 bits. So you can see for the zero code, we're still using more bits than really works, than they actually carry. For the intermediate probabilities, we actually win on one and lose on the other, probably overall average win. And on the 4 bit code, we're sort of winning a little bit in terms of bits transmitted. The average bits per symbol comes out at 1.75 instead of 1.70, which is the actual information in the source. So it actually works quite well. Remarkably simple procedure. You can actually prove that it gets within a gnat's bollock of the optimum result. The problem, the reason it doesn't make it, is things like the naught bit. Right, naught's only worth 0.74 bits. We've got to use 1 bit. We have to use quantum amounts of bits. Right, bits are a bit, you know, it's a bit like being pregnant. You either have 1 bit or 2 bits. You can't be 0.5 pregnant. Right, you either. All right, it's the same deal there. So, and that's the main reason. You get these inefficiencies, it doesn't quite make it. Of course, if you make the words bigger, if you have a much larger symbol set, you can more closely get to the optimal bound, and the bigger you make it, the better you get. But there's a problem with that. Hamming Huffman coding does have some disadvantages. One is it needs a lot of computation and storage. You've got to hold the whole tree in memory. So for a 32-bit, no, let's do it for a 24-bit. For a 24-bit signal, that's 16 million memory locations plus associated overhead. Okay, these days we could do that. You can buy a computer with 8 gigs of memory in and probably manage that. 32-bit, getting tricky. 64-bit, still into the 9 million main names of billion names of God territory there, or Towers of Hanoi. Okay, so one of the problems is really, it doesn't work for stuff bigger than about 24, 25 bits with practical technology, okay? That's actually less of a problem getting the statistics to support it, right? Because gathering enough statistics can be a problem. I, with one 4 minute and 46 second song, couldn't gather enough statistics to do CDs worth. I would actually have to probably take a lot of stuff together to actually get enough statistics to do Huffman coding for a 16-bit 65536 symbol set. Also, you've got to tell the other end what the probabilities are for everything to be unscrambled, and transmitting the tables to the receiver, if you're doing it that way, can use a lot of bits. Of course, if both of you can agree ahead of time that everybody's going to use the same table, which is what they do in MPEG, then you don't have to transmit those to the other end. So it's really suitable for small alphabets, for R5 level, 7 level, etc. quantizers, but not really so good for the 16-bit CDs we have, or if we've done some redundancy removal, 32-bit integers or whatever we're dealing with after that. So what could we use for a CD? Well, we could use Golem coding. Oh dear, that's a spelling mistake, never mind. Let's go back to the self-information of a CD track, and particularly look at this in terms of, I've changed the x-axis and I've divided it up a little bit smaller. I've divided it into chunks of 1,000 now. And if you look at that, sort of eyeball it, it's actually slightly less than 1,000, but you can see that linear slope. It takes about 1,000 levels to move one bit of entropy in the level because of this exponential decrease in probability. We get a linear increase in the number of bits of self-information as we go up in level. And it's on the order of, it's not quite 1,000, but it's a linear scale. But it's approximately one bit per 1,000 levels. Right. What can we do with that? Well, what we can do with that is, it's actually called Gollum, not Gollum. I'm sure you get sick and tired of that joke. Code the remainder actually using... Oops, sorry, I've gone a bit ahead of myself. Oh, I've missed a bit out. I'm sorry. Right, okay. What we do is we divide the whole thing into those ranges, like ranges of 1,024. So we make a quotient, so we divide the number into a quotient and remainder. And we actually code the remainder using some other binary code. If it's m to the power of 2, which is Gollum-Rice coding, the answer is easy. We just use standard binary coding. If m is less than a power of 2, in between powers of 2, then there's a fancy technique called truncated binary, which I won't go into. Or, which might be interesting for that bottom first range, where we know 0 is much more likely than anything else, actually use Huffman coding within the range to encode that remainder. And for the quotient, the bit that's divided those areas in, so the first range would be quotient of 0, divides by 1, 2, etc., etc., up to however many you want to do. For a CD, it would be up to about 16 or thereabouts. 65. It'd be up to about 65. Okay. But you encode that with something called a thermometer code. I've lost a slide here. I'm sorry about that. What we do is we code the quotient using something called a thermometer code. Not quite sure where that's gone. All right, never mind. I had a perfect example of it and everything. The thermometer code is very simple. It starts with a 0, and then for every bit, every level you add another bit. So 0 is coded as 0, 1 is coded as 0,1, 2 is coded as 0,1,1, 3 is coded as 0,1,1,1, etc., etc. On the face of it, a completely stupid thing to do, because for a 65,000 level signal, you're going to code up to 65 bits to do this thing. Okay, but that top level is really unlikely to happen and actually has an information content of 65 bits because of that exponential decay. So when you actually work out the result, it's remarkably efficient, right? You actually end up using 12.7 bits per symbol on average. And the entropy is actually 11.6, so you're about one and a bit bits extra. And it's very interesting why you're that bad. It's good in one sense, but you're thinking, why am I one bit extra? That one bit is the necessary naught in the front. And you can't, I've thought about it, you can't get rid of it. It's a bugger, but you can't get rid of it. Okay? But, remember, this is just on the CD track. CDs and any music, right, we need to maximize the information content via not just entropy coding, but redundancy removal. And if we actually look, our ideal source and symbols are not ideal source, symbols are independent. These die. If I've rolled a 8 first, I can roll an 11. Doesn't matter what I've rolled before. Everything's 18. Everything's independent. So, audio samples are not independent. In fact, all audio samples, I will say to you, are effectively filtered, and not by the anti-alias filter, just because they come from real sources. The only audio source that's unfiltered is an impulse or white noise. And I think we'll all agree those noises very rarely occur in nature. And I brought a little example. I thought the way to do this is to bring a resonator along. And we all know what happens. So if we hit a resonator, well, I'm probably do it two different ways, but right, makes a nice noise, doesn't it? If I change, or sorry, I should blow on it as well. If I hit it with some white noise, I get a sort of boomy thing. If I change the volume a little bit, this is just a handy receptacle to change the volume. That didn't change. Did it? Only changed, well, a little bit. I'm sure this was full when I started the journey from Manchester. Still doesn't change much. Okay, so hasn't changed much. Think I need a different example resonator to work from. So here's a fresh resonator. Unfortunately, it's been in my case. All right, but right, boop, boom. Okay, change the volume a little bit. All right, change it a little bit more. But the point is, this has an impulse response. This, if you can hear it, the sound lies around for a few fractions of a second after the impulse has hit it. So, any real musical instrument, musical noise that we're actually going to find interesting, has gone through some sort of filtering. I mean, unless you're an aficionado of square waves and triangle waves and sawtooths, most of us prefer it if it's gone through a filter. Okay, so in practice, real sources actually have this effect where the current sample isn't just independent of the previous samples. It contains quite a bit of predictable stuff, and actually only a small amount of it is unpredictable. In fact, the control engineers call the unpredictable bit the innovation sequence, the actual bit that's in unpredictable. So all audio signals are effectively filtered. That is, if we looked at their frequency response, it would be non-flat. And if we did a little detailed analysis of the correlation between the current sample and the previous samples, we'd find that the current sample has, you know, a little bit of the previous samples hanging around in it. A bit like forensics, you know. They're always going to find bits of DNA lying around at the scene of the crime. Well, our sample has a bit of the previous samples of DNA lying around on it. Right. So, what can we do about that? Well, obvious thing to do is get rid of it, because it's predictable. If it's predictable, so long as we know the unpredictable stuff, we can reintroduce the predictable stuff. So if we remove the predictability, we'd have a more surprising signal. That would be a signal that would be worth more bits, carried more information effectively. And there are two main ways of removing this redundancy. There's a time domain method via time domain prediction, and less easy to see, I think, and less intuitive, but frequency domain methods via frequency domain processing. And I'll just have a quick go through each of those. Time domain prediction, right. This is the method used by most lossless encoding schemes. I know there's an MPEG-4 standard that does have a transform in it, but all the ones that you've got on the sort of market and available usually have a time domain predictor in it. Ooh. That's a little bit fierce. I didn't feel I had time to cut a lemon in the presentation, so I have to do without that. Right. What the time domain prediction does is it works out from the signal using a method called linear prediction that I don't want to go into. It's a fairly standard method of solving some simultaneous equations. Actually works at the inverse filter to the spectrum of the signal coming in, and then uses that filter to remove correlated components from the input signal. right? And it's reasonably clever because it only uses prior information. It doesn't have to look into the future, okay? And at the decoder, the original signal is actually recovered by essentially feeding the decoded signal back into the complementary filter, which re-puts the correlations back into the signal, all right? Very nice. The only problem with it is that, again, what's it we like about music? What makes it interesting? Change, surprise. Real music is dynamic, it changes, and you have to change the filter fairly regularly. And that means you've got to send some filter coefficients to the receive end so that the decoder can restore the correlation correctly. Right, so because real signals vary in time, different notes, different instruments, you've got to recalculate the required filter and resend the coefficients. Typically, on the order of 50 to 100 times a second. The system is actually known as a forward adaptive predictor because it explicitly sends the necessary information, reconstruction information, to the decoder. There is actually a method called backward adaptive prediction, or Ousland filter, because that uses the data stream actually sent to do the adaptation on. I know this, I have a patent on an Ousland filter, an expired patent. A disadvantage of time domain prediction, and this is true for forward or backward, is that errors that occur between the decoder and the encoder and the decoder are basically remembered forever like an elephant. In the case of a backward adaptive system, in fact, what usually happens is the error goes round and round and round and round and round and round and round, and actually the whole thing becomes unstable, disappears up the way the user Ousland bird does, and usually results in smoke rising from tweeters and people screaming about their ears. My patent actually was on a way of trying to stop that happening. But, okay, so that's time domain. Quite useful, but time domain redundancy removal isn't used in the lossy codecs. Lossy codecs use a bank of filters and a discrete cosine transform, or just a discrete cosine transform, okay? And it's doing redundancy removal in the frequency domain. And I think it's a little less intuitive to work out what's going on. But again, let's just think of two simple examples. Consider a sine wave. We've already agreed it carries no information. And if we look in the time domain, it's got a fairly busy waveform. It covers all the levels, stuff like that. Has a time domain sort of fullness. But if we do a Fourier transform of it, it's one complex coefficient specifying rate of change of phase and amplitude and its phase. Okay, single complex value. If we consider random noise, in theory an ideal information source, it carries maximum information, it has a complex time domain waveform, but then in the Fourier domain requires all of the coefficients to characterize it. So information rich, lots of Fourier coefficients, information poor, one Fourier coefficient. So we can actually think of transforms, and this is not true of all transforms, but transforms can concentrate signals that have correlations between samples, as they directly imply some form of spectral redundancy. The minute we do filtering, we're changing the spectrum. We're introducing spectral redundancy. But what sort of transform is best? I've mentioned the Fourier transform. What about it? Discrete Fourier transform has complex coefficients. That's bad news because it produces 2 times n outputs for n samples in. So we've just blown the number of samples to encode up. Makes our problem a lot harder, even if we take advantage of the symmetry of real input. It basically is kind of a bust as far as coding's concerned. Ideally, one should use principal component analysis, or Cahoon and Loew transform is a posh name for it, because what that does is concentrates the dependencies in the signal into the minimum number of coefficients required to describe it. That's the whole point of principal component analysis. And it's a transform. Each component is orthogonal, everything else. All right? So theoretically, concentrates the information to a minimum number of orthogonal coefficients. But it's computationally complex, and it generates basis functions that you'd also have to send to the receive end to reconstruct it. So it's probably a bit of a bust as well, except for one funny little interesting fact. If you look at the discrete cosine transform and the basis functions for Cahoon and Loew on audio signals, which tend to come from resonant processes, you find that the basis functions are very close to cosine waves. So the discrete cosine function just fortuitously happens to be pretty close to what you'd get if you did the proper thing. Because most of the correlations are due to recursive processes. You hit it, energy rattles round and leaks out over a period of time. Okay, so this is the method used by most of the lossy schemes, because either using the DCT by itself or in combination with the filter bank, you split the audio into many small bands. In principle, the smaller the better, but there's a limit to how far you can go because smaller bands have longer time responses. And this is a tension in transform coding. Because once we start looking at the psychoacoustic stuff, there is some limitations due to temporal masking, and the time extent of the signal is limited to 8 to 25 milliseconds, which means bandwidths on the order of 125-40 hertz comes up to sort of 2,048 samples at audio rate, that sort of order. So there's a limit to how far you can go, but it does allow the coder to flag bands that contain no energy at all and therefore don't need to be transmitted. And very importantly, it makes your job of psychoacoustic quantization easier to do. Having a frequency domain represent a frequency domain-like representation of the signal that you can fiddle about and control like a big graphic equalizer is a lot easier to deal with than time domain signals. So, again, let's go back to our archetypal codec again. We've looked at the entropy coder and information. We found that real signals, in general, are much more likely to have low signal levels and high signal levels, and that using fixed bit words is an inefficient way of coding them. Much better to use variable length codes. Even better if we remove the redundancy from the signal and actually make the samples as independent as possible, as surprising as possible, then we can combine those two together to form a lossless type coder, which typically these days gives you about a 2-to-1 reduction in signal bandwidth or number of bits you need to transmit the signal. However, some of our media still require lower bit rates, so we have to actually start throwing away information. And the best way to do that is to do it with reference to your psychoacoustics. So how do we psychoacoustically remove information? All right, let's just have a little bit of a look at psychoacoustics. Psychoacoustic quantization is based on a couple of premises. First, the threshold of hearing is not constant with frequency. We're much more sensitive to stuff around the 4 to 5 kilohertz region than we are to stuff at 20 hertz or stuff above 12 kilohertz. If you're my age and getting up to 55, I think I can push that down to about 8 kilohertz nowadays. I'm conscious I can't hear my boyfriend's dog whistling when he's upset, which is really, just don't hear it. It's kind of useful. but it does get you into trouble sometimes. So that's one thing. The threshold of hearing is not constant with frequency. So we can play a bit with that, in that we're probably more sensitive to low-level noises around the 6 kilohertz region, probably can get away with a bit more noise up near 20 kilohertz and down below 100 hertz. Okay. More importantly, when it comes to MPEG, we have this interesting thing that loud sounds in the frequency domain actually mask weaker sounds in the spectrum. It's called simultaneous masking. The plot at the bottom is in equivalent rectangular frequency bands, so it's a kind of logarithmic scale that corresponds to the way we hear, and it turns out our thresholds come out as straight lines. But you can see there that the masking signal, basically anything below those lines is not heard, anything above is heard. So if we had musical components theoretically sitting below those thresholds, we wouldn't hear them, and you could then therefore not code them and expect to reasonably get at least cause less distortion than coding components whose peaks stuck above those thresholds. So it's called simultaneous masking, and we have this case of that strong signals in frequency, masked frequencies nearby. So we can use that. And the other thing to note about it is it's level dependent and asymmetric with frequency. So you can see that as you increase the level, the masking spreads further upwards in frequency, and low tones are much more effective at masking high frequency tones than the other way around. That's actually due to a physical reason. The way our cochlea works is that low frequencies get much further down the little snail than high frequencies, and low frequencies still wiggle the bit near the oval window, just not as much as they do further down, but they still can interfere with the bits the high frequencies do. So it's sort of physiologically caused property. Right, so that's simultaneous masking. We also have temporal masking, one called forward masking, which is sort of the logical one, where a big sound happening before a softer sound masks the softer sound. And you can see there it extends over, you know, quite a few tens of milliseconds. More contentiously, I know Brian Moore believes this is an artifact of poor experimental practice, but, well, he does. He's quite... yeah, not unreasonably. He's a bright guy and he does know his experimental stuff. So his argument, this one doesn't exist. But we sort of use it. It's sort of critical to our MPEG coder designs. All right. If backward masking didn't exist, we'd have to have a frame size of zero. Okay. So, there may be evidence coming up for that. But backward masking, where a loud sound happening immediately after quieter sound effectively masks it, actually covers a much shorter time extent, all right? It's, again, time and level dependent, and effectively the backward masking limits the frame sizes for coding, because if you have a frame where a loud sound happens at the end of the frame, then you might allocate the bits according to that loud sound, because it's the thing that's kind of dominating all the information in your frame, which might mean that quantization noise caused by that is actually unmasked at the beginning of the frame. And I think you can hear that in some low bit rate coding. You hear the sort of burbling noise going on. I think that's basically stuff becoming unmasked in the frame. And it's burbling because it's basically modulated by the frame rate. Right. So, as I said, psychoacoustic quantization is usually done in the frequency domain. If you look at it, there's loads of different ways of doing it. MPEG doesn't actually limit you on what you do for your psychoacoustic bit allocation. It gives you a set of rules to specify the bits for the receiver to put it back together again. But quite cleverly, they didn't specify how you did it. So in principle, you can improve that section. And most of the ones that are used at the moment are iterative optimization processes. The only way I can describe it is they allocate some bits, work out what it's going to sound like with some psychoacoustic model, say, oh, that's not good enough, let's try tweaking it a little bit, and go around the loop a few times. It tries to simultaneously optimize rate and distortion. So it's kind of a complicated optimization problem. Let me go back to that. There are issues with it, and if you look at MPEG-4, there's a whole bunch of toolboxes to get around the problems caused by having a frame-based system and human ears that won't meet. You know, our ears are not Fourier transformers, and frequency doesn't exist. We've got a set of non-uniform bandpass filters that listen to things, and you've got things like TNS, time domain noise shaping, which tries to bend the noise around the frame so you don't hear it popping up at awkward points and stuff like that. And there's basically a whole bunch of toolboxes, long and short frames to cover, slow stuff which you can do much better, and fast stuff that you can't do so well with the slow stuff and things like that. And it's basically quite a complicated process with lots of little bolt-ons to try and make it work better. And as I said, this is all a iterative process that tries to simultaneously optimize rate and distortion, and is computationally probably intractable if one was trying to do it properly. There is another way of doing it. You can do noise shaping in the time domain. And I've got a little example here, which I think I'm going to have to go back to my screen to do. All right. This is just a little 10-second clip. But this is noise shaping, just done with a static filter. There's no reason why that filter couldn't be a dynamic filter and vary in time. Of course, you'd still have to send coefficients to the receiver and things like that, but you could have a time-varying noise shaping filter. This is a fixed noise shaping filter. And again, a little clip from the track I use for my statistics. It's all right, it's a mercifully short clip. Right, you could hear the noise. 10 bits quantization, sorry, 8 bits of quantization. Old cassette tape without noise reduction signal to noise ratio. With triangular dither. Did it properly. Lipschitz would be proud of me. All right, triangular dither, okay. Borrowed Lipschitz's numbers. I set this as an assignment for the students in the second year of first semester. And second order noise shaping filter. Same number of bits, 8 bits of quantization. Different? Right? Quite noticeably different. And all it's done, in fact, the total noise in the second clip is higher than the noise in the first clip by a reasonable number of dBs. But what it's done is it's pushed it away from 4 kHz. There's a bit down at low frequencies and a hell of a lot. In fact, if you listen to the character of the noise, it's much more sort of high frequency noise. But that's just very simple fixed noise shaping. Didn't do a bad job on 8 bits worth of quantization, obviously. And of course, we do use that for our 16-bit CDs these days. When you master them from higher bit levels, they do use that sort of psychoacoustic noise shaping to try and improve the threshold noise level. But again, in principle, there's no reason why you can't vary a noise shaping filter in the time domain as well. Speech guys do it all the time. Right, so that's sort of it for the descriptions. What's next? Well, I think we can do a lot better on redundancy removal. I still think lossless coding is an interesting area to work on because our download bandwidths and speeds are getting better and better as time goes on, really quite quickly. I bought my boyfriend a 16 gigabyte flash memory video stroke, MPEG player last year. It cost 70 quid. It's 16 gigabytes, for God's sake, in a battery-powered piece of kit. And there was a 32 gigabyte available. I think you can buy a 64 gigabyte iPhone nowadays. I don't know how long the battery lasts, probably about 10 milliseconds. But, it's there. And, every year it goes on, that number gets bigger. So in a sense, storage isn't beings and download bandwidth isn't so much of an issue. And if we can losslessly compress the signal, we can save some time and some resources on bandwidth and still, have the advantage of having a bit-for-bit copy at the other end. And I actually think, if I look at what they're doing at the moment for redundancy removal, they're not really taking full advantage of the information we've got. They're still using the old paradigm, computation's expensive, and we're looking at it like speech coders from the 1970s. We could take advantage of a priori information. We could look for note boundaries, for example, and actually encode note sizes and do pitch prediction on the whole notes. You could even consider looking at vibrato and working on that as well. Perfectly feasible things. Computationally, a bit of a nightmare, but computation isn't a problem. So we could do more careful optimization of the removal process and possibly actually get rid of a lot more redundancy. As far as I can see, most of the redundancy being removed at the moment is gross spectral features and not that much fine detail, because fine detail is a little bit trickier to do. And that would give you better lossless coding. For our lossy coders, really, we have to go to better optimization on the psychoacoustic quantization, which is built on psychoacoustic models. And I think one of the interesting things that's come out of the MPEG-3 coding thing is we've learned a hell of a lot more about psychoacoustics than we knew before they started. I mean, the old MPEG-1 was based on models that were developed in the 1930s and 40s and measured on dead ears. And, you know, people realized that it didn't work as well as they thought it would work and have actually refined their models as a result of bitter experience, which, you know, is a good way of doing it. So better models, but I think both of these things, the real key is computation is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. In fact, memory accesses are things that's getting expensive compared to computation these days. But, you know, your graphics chip on your computer that you're carrying around your laptop probably has 128 processors running in parallel. And that's on a laptop. On your desktop, if you're into heavy-duty games, you could have nearly 1,000 of the damn things running, right? With that sort of computation power, you could do a lot, lot better job on doing these sorts of coding. And as it's a mastering problem, you've got the time. You're not limited with real-time constraints for audio feedback. You've got the time to do the job right as well. Right. So, in conclusion, that's about it. Thank you. Any questions?